expenses, Lisbeth has told them multiple times, and yet Edie says nothing to anyone because she loathes a tattletale. Then there are the Marsh children. Edie helped Wanda write an article about the ghost, and when Wanda grew emotional and asked why nobody had saved Grace Hadley, Edie gave her a hug and said that was a long time ago, before there were smoke detectors. Edie also found Louis a chess instructor, a house painter named Rustam, who had been a chess champion back in Uzbekistan. Edie would like to ask Kimber to write a travel tattler review. Kimber would surely mention Edie, but she can't bring herself to campaign on her own behalf. Alessandra has won the bonus 3 weeks in a row. This is a side stitch that stays with Edie through all her working hours. It's cathartic to hear that it bugs Zeke as well. Do Adam and Raoul ever tell you what it's like to live with her? Edie asks. Zeke rolls his eyes. Adam says she hardly ever sleeps there. What? Edie says. She rolls in at 5 or 6 in the morning when Raoul is getting up to exercise, Zeke says. She's out on the prowl, I guess. Edie isn't exactly surprised to hear this. Alessandra exudes a discreet but undeniable sexuality, but she won't take part in any slut-shaming. If anything, Edie feels freshly hurt that Alessandra has chosen to confide exactly nothing in her, even though they work side by side all day long. Alessandra is always civil, but never friendly or warm. Why? Beneath Alessandra's polished facade is something else, Edie thinks. A broken doll, a smashed mirror. Alessandra is damaged. Or maybe Edie is just making excuses for her. Graydon used to tell Edie she should stop giving other people so much credit. Zeke finishes his ice cream and stands up. I'm heading home. He gives Edie his slow, beautiful smile. I think we should start spying on Alessandra to figure out how she's winning the money. Start spying on her? Edie thinks. Are they back in middle school? The idea, however, is not without its appeal. Edie likes the thought of having a little conspiracy going with Zeke. I'll see what I can find out, Edie says, though she knows she will find out nothing. Alessandra is all zippered up. Here, take my number, Zeke says. He picks up Edie's phone. Someone named Graydon has requested a $500 Venmo, he says. He grins at Edie. Who's Graydon? Your bookie? Edie wants to snatch the phone from his hand, but she just laughs. Something like that. She watches Zeke type his number into her phone, but the thrill that should accompany getting Zeke English's cell phone number is missing. When Zeke hands back her phone, Edie sees the Venmo request, and her face burns with shame. She has no right to judge Alessandra. I'll see you tomorrow. See ya, Zeke says. And he leaves her sitting with what is now a bowl of cold chocolate soup. $500. Edie checks the date. It's exactly 3 weeks since Graydon's last Venmo request, which came exactly 3 weeks after his first Venmo request. The regularity of the extortion gives Edie an odd comfort. Graydon isn't asking more frequently or asking for more money. Edie wonders if she can just think of this like a car payment or a stupidity tax. But no, sorry, that's absurd. She has lost $1,000 of her hard-earned money already, and she's not going to buckle this time. Graydon is angry about the breakup, and maybe he's lonely out in Arizona, but even so, he would never send those videos out. They would embarrass him as much as her. She deletes the Venmo request, but then, as though he's watching her somehow, a text comes in from him. It's her mother's cell phone number and email. Edie stops breathing for a second. She sends him the money. Chapter 16. The Cobblestone Telegraph. Jordan Randolph, publisher of the Nantucket Standard, has been sitting on Jill Tannenbaum's article about the Hotel Nantucket for well over a month, but he hasn't been inspired to run it. Part of the reason is his own prejudice about the hotel being owned by a renowned London billionaire who has never even set foot on the island. It feels so wrong. And part of it is that Jordan likes to cover the real issues facing Nantucket. There's the housing shortage, which causes overcrowded conditions for both seasonal and year-round workers. There's the traffic. In the summer, Jordan avoids the intersection by the high school altogether. There's environmental sustainability, the argument against short-term rentals, and issues with the landfill. Nantucket is, in Jordan's opinion, already too popular, so inundated with visitors that the people who live here can't enjoy it. Jordan realizes this makes him sound like a crotchety old-timer. Really, what he wishes is that there were a story to the hotel's renovation that didn't have to do with money, thread count, or Farrowin ball paint. And then suddenly, that story lands on his desk. Edie Robbins comes into the office with an article written by an 8-year-old girl, a guest at the hotel. This child, Wanda Marsh, claims to have heard from a ghost living in the hotel's 4th-floor storage room. Jordan reads the piece and chuckles. It's not bad. Maybe he should hire this Wanda Marsh. And then Edie hands over the supporting document, an article published in The Standard 100 years ago.
I never knew about this, Jordan admits.
There are, of course, ghost stories all over downtown Nantucket, just as there are in any historic place with creaky old houses. But this one grabs Jordan's interest. It's the combination of the 100-year anniversary angle, the little girl, and Edie herself, a young woman Jordan has known since birth. Jordan was friends with Edie's father, Vance Robbins. They served on the Rotary Club scholarship committee together for years, and Jordan was saddened by his passing. He gives the little girl's story and the old article to Jill and asks her to write a new piece about the hotel. Describe the renovation from the point of view of the ghost who has lived there for the past 100 years, he says. People will love it. And they do. Jill Tannenbaum's article, Hotel Nantucket Haunted by Hadley, appears in the Thursday, July 21st edition of the Nantucket Standard and garners more reader response than any other article they've run this year. Summer visitor Donna Fenton, who stayed in the hotel with her family in the 1980s, knew there was something spooky about the place. Blonde Sharon is intrigued not by the ghost, but by the matuk linens, the oyster shell tiled showers, and the blue cashmere throws from Nantucket looms. Also, Sharon, who likes to know everything, had no idea there was a new adult pool out back. How can she get an invitation? She decides to book a room at the end of August for her sister Heather, who is a world traveler and very discerning. It just so happens that Yungja Park, a writer for the Associated Press, is staying on the island at her parents' home in Shimo. And after she reads the article in The Standard, she writes an article about the haunted hotel as well. She tracks down 6 people who have stayed at the hotel over the past 3 decades, 3 of whom claim to have heard and seen things they couldn't explain. Yungja's article gets picked up by 47 newspapers across the country, from the Idaho Statesman to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch to the Tampa Bay Times. Some of the papers run the article right away. Some save it for a slow news day. Here on Nantucket, the excitement about the haunted hotel lasts only a scant 24 hours, because we have other gossip to discuss. Something very scandalous has transpired on Hulbert Avenue. Rumor has it that Michael Bick, husband of Heidi Bick and the father of 4, had an affair with their next-door neighbor, Lyric Layton, and Lyric is now pregnant. This story is so salacious that Blonde Sharon will be able to dine out on it all summer long. Apparently, Heidi Bick found Lyric's eyeshadow in her makeup drawer, Lyric's Rene Cauvilla stilettos in her closet, and Lyric's positive pregnancy test inside the Jennifer Weiner novel, Good in Bed. Is there symbolism in this choice of book? There must be. Heidi invited the Laytons over for dinner on the deck, faking normality. But as soon as the first cocktail was poured, she confronted Michael and Lyric. It was a surprise attack, so they couldn't confer and get their story straight. Whoa, did this cause an uproar, mostly from Ari Layton, who had been mentally keeping track of how many times Michael checked out his wife these past few years. Ari had always suspected a flirtation between his wife and Michael, but he was enraged to find out it was something far more. Ari had been so happy about Lyric's pregnancy,
He was hoping for a little girl after three boys, but what if it turned out it wasn't his baby? Ari stood up, fists at the ready. Both Michael and Lyric vehemently denied the accusation. They had never been together in any capacity, nor would they ever. Lyric was appalled that Heidi thought so little of her. She wasn't sure what her eyeshadow, shoes, and pregnancy test were doing in the Bix house, but for the record, if she were having an affair with Michael, she wouldn't be stupid enough to leave those things behind. Here, we had to admit, she had a point. Michael claimed he was being set up. It was probably someone from his office who had found out he and Rafe were starting their own company. They'd sent a spy into the house. The guy who came to fix the internet, perhaps? Ari said, "But how would anyone from your company get into our house? How would he know to take the eyeshadow, shoes, and pregnancy test, which he must have found in our trash?" Right, we thought. It made no sense. Lyric was, by all accounts, calm but emphatic. She was happy to have the paternity of the baby tested as soon as that was an option. Michael, however, kept spewing conspiracy theories and generally acting like a man with a guilty conscience. This made us wonder. There has also been a shakeup at the deck, one so disruptive that the restaurant announces a temporary emergency closing on Sunday, July 17th. The deck hasn't closed on a summer Sunday in 15 years of operation. What is going on? Romeo, down at the Steamship Authority, reports that he saw Christina Cross driving her bright orange Jeep onto the ferry, her belongings packed to within inches of the roof. It's Romeo's job to regulate that kind of thing. Drivers are supposed to have a foot of visual clearance out the back window. But when Romeo approaches the car, he sees Christina is sobbing, so he waves her on. He has been doing this job for decades and knows a heartbroken woman leaving the island for good when he sees one. Christina has left the deck. Is that why they closed? Yes and no. Christina could easily be replaced by Peyton as hostess and Goose as sommelier. But Goose, who is JJ's closest confidant, tells his sister Janice, the dental hygienist, that JJ closed the deck so that he could take a personal day, which involved a case of Cisco beer, a couple of three-way sandwiches from Yezzy's food truck, and a ride with Goose out to Great Point to fish. He told Goose that Christina had left, but that wasn't the problem. The problem, JJ said, was that he had gotten mixed up with Christina in the first place. "I had the best woman I could have asked for," JJ said. "Lisbeth was my friend, my confidant, someone I knew I could spend the rest of my life with. And I blew it." "You blew it," Goose agreed. Chapter 17. Hot Girl Summer. Business at the Hotel Nantucket has picked up considerably. Grace notes this with delight, and although it feels immodest to say, she knows it's all thanks to her. By the end of July, every room at the hotel is booked. Word has gotten out that the hotel is haunted by the ghost of Grace Hadley, and everyone wants to experience the phenomenon. This is Grace's 15 minutes of fame, and she can't afford to squander it. She's very busy in the nighttime hours making benign room visits. She knocks on walls, flickers the lights, messes with the electric shades, this is so much fun, and plays the guests' favorite songs out of nowhere. These shenanigans delight the guests, but Grace begins to worry that cheap stunts will dilute her brand. Can she put her powers to better use? Yes. For example, 17-year-old Juliana Plum wants to come out to her parents. They're staying in Suite 314, and they've just had a lovely dinner at the Languedoc Bistro. As they were walking down the hallway toward their suite, Mr. Plum teased Juliana about the cute busboy who had been flirting with her at dinner. Juliana looked uncomfortable, and Grace knows exactly why. She watches Juliana stare at herself for a long time in the bathroom mirror after brushing her teeth. Grace marvels at how wonderful it is that one can just state one's sexual orientation and preferences in 2022. Back in 1922, well,
Grace had a feeling that the hotel's GM, Mr. Leroy Noonan, preferred gentlemen, but he could never have said it. He was more closeted than Grace was. Grace follows Juliana as she knocks on her parents' bedroom door. "Come in," Mrs. Plum says. Juliana and Grace enter. Grace hovers close to Juliana, providing as much warmth and support as she can muster. "I'm gay," Juliana says. The Plums seem taken aback. Mr. Plum clears his throat. He exchanges glances with Mrs. Plum. Grace nudges Mr. Plum toward his daughter, and Mr. Plum gets the hint and holds out his arms. "Juliana," he says, "we love you, sweetie."
"Thank you for trusting us enough to tell us," Mrs. Plum says. "We'll support you any way we can."
"My work here is done," Grace thinks, leaving the Plums to a group hug. Grace discovers that the Alpines in room 203 have been experiencing some problems in the bedroom and that they're taking this vacation to spice things up and reignite the romance in their marriage. But despite the mood lighting and the fine linens, Grace reads the room and senses the Alpines are headed for disappointment and, very likely, some counseling. She positions herself just so in front of the full-length mirror and within Mr. Alpine's line of vision. Is he supernaturally sensitive? Let's hope so, for Mrs. Alpine's sake. Grace blows cold air toward Mr. Alpine and opens her robe. He looks over Mrs. Alpine's shoulder, and his eyes widen. It turns out that being watched by a beautiful, young, and naked female ghost is just the thing to cure Mr. Alpine of his chronic issue. Grace slips out, leaving the Alpines to get down to business. Kimber goes to the Daria salon at the White Elephant and returns with her hair dyed flame orange. Richie loves it, Wanda and Louie are nonplussed, and Doug the dog barks so sharply when he sees her that Kimber has to put on his muzzle. Grace is not unhappy about this. Now, nearly every night after the Blue Bar closes and Adam heads home, Kimber slips down the hall to the lobby to visit Richie. Their fooling around has gotten too serious for them to stay out in the open in the lobby. What if a guest should appear or one of the children wander down? So they are constantly looking for more private places to be together. Kimber suggests the fourth floor storage room, but thankfully, Richie shoots this idea down. "It's spooky," he says. He thinks they should go out to the adult pool and get busy on one of the extra-wide chaise longues. They try this, but although the chaises are sturdy, they aren't that sturdy, and Kimber complains about the mosquitoes. Kimber tries to lure Richie down to her suite, but Richie is concerned about the children. They finally consummate their relationship in the break room. When Richie plays Marvin Gaye on the jukebox, Grace knows what's coming and floats out. The break room becomes the regular site of their sneaky links. Grace notices that after Kimber heads back to her suite, Richie often falls asleep on the sofa, then jolts awake like he's being chased. Grace has nothing to do with this. She suspects it's his conscience at work. Sometimes he sits for long periods with his head in his hands. Sometimes he goes into Lisbeth's office, opens the safe, and stares at the piles of Kimber's cash, though Grace is happy to report he doesn't take a single dollar. He stays at the hotel until the birds begin to sing, then he slithers out the side door like a cat burglar. Kimber tells Richie that she has to go off-island overnight the following week to meet with her divorce attorney, and she doesn't want to take the children with her. She asks Richie if there's any way he can sleep in her suite after he's finished work and spend the 2 days that Kimber will be away with the children. "Yes, of course," Richie practically shouts. "He'd love to." Kimber tells Richie that the best way to acclimate the children to him staying over while she's away is for him to stay overnight in their suite on a regular basis while she's there.
"The children will be fine with it," Kimber says.
She has spent so much time in the sun that her once wan skin is now a subtle golden, and her hair holds appealing beachy waves. She's also, Grace notes, glowing from within.
"They won't blink an eye."
"Well, that may be so,"
Richie says, but it's against the rules. Staff aren't allowed to sleep with the guests, Kimber.
Let's go talk to Lisbeth, Kimber says.
We can't, Richie says. I'll get fired.
Kimber laughs. You work 7 nights a week. You barely even go home. She's not going to fire you because she'll never, ever find anyone to replace you. We're consenting adults. We'll ask permission. Lisbeth will understand.
Grace thinks, this is a gamble. Lisbeth has been known to stretch some rules, but to blatantly break one like a stick over her knee? Grace watches as Kimber leads Richie by the hand to the door of Lisbeth's office. They enter together, Richie hanging back slightly, like a delinquent child.
Good morning, Lisbeth, Kimber says. Just so you know, Richie and I are having a summer romance, and some nights he'll be sleeping with me in the suite. We know this is technically against the rules.
More than technically, Lisbeth says, and Grace thinks she's going to nip it in the bud. But then Lisbeth gazes at Richie and Kimber, and her face softens.
But at this point, you're more family than guest.
Ah, that's so sweet of you to say,
Kimber beams.
That's how the children and I feel too.
Richie clears his throat. I promise to put work first, as always.
Absolutely, Lisbeth says. So no bothering Richie at night anymore, Kimber, okay? He can come to your suite when he's off the clock. Richie, just please be discreet.
Of course, Richie says.
Lisbeth clears her throat. I would never want anything inappropriate happening in, for example, the break room, she says.
Mario's playlist for Lisbeth. Love Walks In, Van Halen. Strange Currencies, R.E.M. Kiss, Prince. Next to You, The Police. OMG, Usher. Girlfriend, Matthew Sweet. Can't Feel My Face, The Weeknd. Dreaming, Blondie. In a Little While, U2. Killing Me Softly, The Fugees. Soulshine, Martin Deschamps. The Guy That Says Goodbye to You Is Out of His Mind, Griffin House. Nothing on You, B.O.B. Loving Cup, The Rolling Stones and Jack White. Are You Gonna Be My Girl, Jet. Sister Golden Hair, America. Never Been in Love, Cobra Starship. Sleep All Right, Ginger Soul. Here Comes the Sun, The Beatles. Sexual Healing, Marvin Gaye. Summertime, Kenny Chesney. Lisbeth feels like a bubble in a flute of champagne. Her outlook is golden and effervescent. It's as though all of her inspirational memes have come true at once. First of all, the hotel is thriving. The article written by Wanda Marsh, an 8-year-old kid, you just can't make this stuff up, started a chain reaction that led to stories about Grace Hadley's ghost being printed in newspapers across the country. The phone rang nonstop, and the website crashed from all the traffic. Lisbeth was tickled by this development, inconvenient though it was. The Hotel Nantucket had broken the internet. Having a busy hotel feels joyous. It feels like a celebration. Every day when Lisbeth walks into the lobby, she's entering the buzziest, most interesting room on the island. Guests gather in the lobby for the percolated coffee. The richness of the coffee is mentioned time and again by guests on Travel Tattler. And the almond croissants, ditto. They read the paper, start conversations, admire the James Ogilvy photograph, and watch Louis play chess. Louis shows up every morning at 7 o'clock sharp, hair combed, glasses polished, little polo shirt buttoned to the top. The chaises by the pool are claimed by 10 a.m. The complimentary shuttles that run to the South Shore's beaches are full. Lisbeth has had the piano tuned, and every night before his shift, Adam comes in and plays show tunes while the guests enjoy the wine and cheese hour. People make requests, sing along, and slip Adam tips. After dinner, many guests forego the lines at the chicken box and the gaslight and instead choose to sit on the front porch of the hotel. They light up the fireplace tables, buy s'mores kits from the front desk, and indulge in their gooeyest marshmallow dreams. Lisbeth would like to believe the hotel has finally hit its stride, but she knows the reason for the Renaissance is the ghost. But once potential guests have their interest piqued by the story of Grace Hadley, they check out the website and see the driftwood and rope canopy beds with the dreamy white shears, the lavish bouquets of lilies and Dutch hydrangeas, the slipper tubs, the adult pool with the wall of climbing roses, the free minibar, and the carved teak ceiling in the yoga studio, and they think, "I'd like to stay here." The influx of guests include the poet laureate of New Mexico, a family of ranchers from Montana, a mushroom grower from Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, a neurosurgeon from Nashville, the owners of an NHL expansion team, a renowned hip-hop producer, a YouTube phenom, and a prominent editor from one of the Big Five publishing houses in New York City. This editor reads Lisbeth's blue book and says she'll pitch it. She gets Lisbeth's email address. The secret of change is to focus all your energy not on fighting the old, but on building the new. Lisbeth is so busy that hours and even days go by when she forgets to be on the lookout for Shelley Carpenter. Now is when Shelley Carpenter will show up. Lisbeth is sure of it. And Lisbeth is also sure that if Shelley slipped in under the radar in the past couple of weeks, she was met with exceptional service. Edie, Alessandra, Richie, Zeke, Adam, and Raoul are all at the top of their games. The only thing going better than Lisbeth's professional life is her love life. Every day, Lisbeth goes to Mario's cottage on her lunch hour. They make love and then he cooks for her. Composed salads with grilled shrimp and creamy chunks of avocado and a side of the homemade cheddar crackers that they used to serve at the Blue Bistro. Or, on a rare day of rain, clam chowder and giant popovers pulled straight from the funny little oven. Sometimes Lisbeth brings a bathing suit and they swim off of Mario's front porch, and then she showers and braids her damp hair. When Mario comes into work at 4 o'clock, he swings by her office with a double espresso. He figured out that the way to her heart is caffeine, and he often brings her a little gift, a cluster of roses, a perfect quahog shell, a great popsicle. He makes her a playlist to replace her breakup playlist. Lisbeth closes her office door, and they kiss like a couple of teenagers for a few stolen minutes before Lisbeth straightens her skirt and Mario his chef's jacket, and they get back to work. When Mario gets home from the bar at night, he sends Lisbeth a text, "I'm home, heartbreaker," or "Sweetest dreams, heartbreaker." He has her in his phone as HB. Breaker, not broken, she thinks. She's healed. She's so healed that when she hears that Christina left JJ, she feels only a pang of pity for JJ. She could have told him that relationship would end badly. She considers calling to see if he's okay, but decides it's best not to. She's consumed with her romance with JJ's idol, the man whose picture she gazed at on the wall of JJ's office for 15 years. It's the kind of crazy plot twist that happens only in novels and movies. But she's living it. She can't believe how happy she is. But then a night comes when Mario doesn't text when he gets home from work. Lisbeth wakes up at 3 in the morning to use the bathroom, checks her phone, finds nothing. What? She thinks. She can't fall back to sleep. The room is too hot. Her mind is a swirl. Did something happen? Is Mario okay? Should Lisbeth call him? Should she go to his cottage? She somehow knows she should do neither. She wonders then why Mario never asks to spend the night at her cottage. She lies awake until the birds start to sing, thinking that this was why Mario said they should be careful. What he'd meant, of course, was that she should be careful. He was probably tired, she thinks. He forgot to text. So what? The next day, Monday, Lisbeth goes to the cottage for lunch as usual and everything is fine. The Blue Bar is closed on Tuesdays, and Mario asks if Lisbeth can take the day or even just the afternoon off so they can spend it together. It's exactly what she's craving, but the hotel has 17 checkouts and 17 check-ins, and Yolanda long ago requested every Tuesday off, and Lisbeth needs to be around to manage Warren, the fitness instructor who fills in, because he can be a little ditzy.
On Tuesday evening, the Blue Bar has a softball game against the Garden Group. After Lisbeth finishes work, she drives out the long stretch of Milestone Road to the Tom Nevers Field to catch the last couple of innings. It's a close game, even though the landscapers are young and in shape and play like real athletes. Mario is wearing an old Ramones t-shirt and his White Sox cap, and when he gets up to bat with the bases loaded, he winks at Lisbeth. She flushes, feeling like she felt when she was 16 and watching her boyfriend, Danny Lamotte, play for the Minnetonka Skippers football team. Mario strikes out swinging, and Lisbeth is almost relieved that he didn't hit a home run and win the game because she realizes she's dangerously close to falling in love with him. Yolanda is up next. As Lisbeth is wondering why Yolanda is on the Blue Bar softball team, and then if the hotel should field its own team, and then who would work if they did field a team, Yolanda wallops a pitch over the center fielder's head, and everyone on base scores. Lisbeth is on her feet cheering along with the rest of the crowd when Yolanda crosses the plate, jumps into Mario's arms, and gives him a kiss on the lips. Suddenly, Lisbeth feels not only like an outsider, but also really freaking jealous. From that moment on, Lisbeth becomes hyper-aware of Mario and Yolanda. Yolanda has always made frequent visits to the Blue Bar kitchen, and Lisbeth assumed that Yolanda needed frequent snacks to fuel her exercise. Yolanda often walked past the desk holding an acai bowl or chia pudding, neither of which were on the menu. The Wednesday after the softball game, Yolanda emerges from the Blue Bar holding a tiny pavlova on the flat of her palm like it's a baby bird. She shows it off to Lisbeth and Edie. It's filled with rose-scented pastry cream and topped with candied rose petals.
"Is this not the most exquisite thing you've ever seen? Mario made it for me."
"Did he?" Lisbeth says. Yolanda strolls away, taking a lusty bite of the pavlova. She can eat whatever she wants and still maintain that slender, supple yoga body, which is reason enough to envy her. Zeke joins Lisbeth and Edie in watching Yolanda descend the stairs to the wellness center.
"You know why she spends so much time in the kitchen, right?" he says.
"Why?"
Lisbeth and Edie say together. Lisbeth gets the distinct feeling the bubble she has been living in is about to pop. Zeke arches his eyebrows and takes a breath to say, "What?" But then a large party enters the lobby, and Zeke, Edie, and Lisbeth snap into guest service mode. A couple of days later, Lisbeth is at Mario's cottage for lunch. It's too hot to cook, so Mario slices up a ripe, juicy melon and serves it with burrata and some salty prosciutto. They go for a swim and shower together afterward. Lisbeth is delirious with happiness, thinking, "Yolanda who? Yolanda what?" Poor Yolanda has been mistakenly cast as the villainess in Lisbeth's mind. She's going to let the Yolanda thing go. While Mario is in his bedroom getting dressed, his cell phone on the kitchen counter, right next to where Lisbeth is winding the last strip of prosciutto around the last crescent of pale green melon, dings with a text. The screen says, "YOLO." The text is printed in the alert. "Hey, can you help me with a thing later?" Followed by the winking tongue-out emoji. Lisbeth feels the prosciutto repeat on her. She has to fight the urge to pick up the phone and check the text stream. Mario has no passcode, so she could easily do this, and then at least she'll know what's going on rather than stumbling around in a dark uncertainty. But at that moment, Mario calls out,
"You getting ready to leave, HB? It's 10 of 2.
Lisbeth doesn't respond. Mario pokes his head out of the bedroom and says,
"Everything okay?"
"Yes," Lisbeth says. "You got a text."
Mario takes his time ambling across the room. He scoops up his phone, checks the text. There's no change in his expression. He just slips the phone into the pocket of his houndstooth pants and heads for the door. He always walks her out the creaky dock back to her car. Lisbeth tries to keep her panic on a very short leash. "Hey, can you help me with a thing later?" "What kind of thing?" Lisbeth wonders. "What kind of help? How much later? What about that emoji?"
It's the lewd face, the wink and lolling tongue. It can only mean something naughty. And what's up with YOLO? Has Lisbeth ever heard anyone call Yolanda this? No. Lisbeth is so consumed with these thoughts that she doesn't speak. And when Mario squeezes her hand and asks again if everything is okay, she lies and says yes. The following Tuesday, Lisbeth can't take off because the plumber is coming to fix a leak in the laundry room, and the water throughout the hotel has to be shut off for 90 minutes. Lisbeth needs to be there to field the inevitable complaints. Mario goes to Nobodir Beach with his staff, and when he comes to pick Lisbeth up for their dinner date that night, they're going to the Pearl, he's not only deeply tan, he's a little drunk. Lisbeth teases him about it, and he says,
I played beer die on the beach with some of the kids from the kitchen. It was a good day, and man, Yolanda can really surf.
Oh, Lisbeth says, Yolanda was there?
She was shredding like Alana Blanchard.
I don't know who that is, Lisbeth snaps. Mario doesn't notice her tone because they have entered the tranquil garden setting of the Pearl Chef's Table. It seats 10, but Mario has reserved it for just the two of them, a lavish gesture. Lisbeth has sat at this table before with JJ and some of the staff of the deck, and she's eager to replace those memories. Mario pulls out her chair. He's here with her, she reminds herself, not Yolanda. She orders a passion fruit Cosmo. The magic of the chef's table is that dishes just appear. Lobster rangoons, tuna martinis with wasabi creme fraiche, the 60-second steak topped with a quail egg, the wok-fried salt and pepper lobster. Because Mario is, in this world, Super Mario, each course comes with a pitch-perfect wine pairing. Lisbeth drinks a little more robustly than she probably should, but who can blame her? Yolanda made it clear when the hotel opened that she wanted Tuesdays off. Is that merely a coincidence? Yolanda is only 29 years old, nearly 10 years younger than Lisbeth, nearly 20 years younger than Mario. She's not only beautiful with a perfect body, but she has the kind of luminous personality that draws people in. Why wouldn't Mario be attracted to Yolanda? When dessert is set down, glistening chunks of fresh mango served with coconut sticky rice, Lisbeth's absolute favorite, she can only stare at it and think, don't say it. But she has held the topic at bay throughout dinner, and the wine has done nothing but nourish her fears.
You know what I was thinking? Mario says. You should add caramels to your s'mores kits. Take it up a notch.
Don't say it, she thinks.
I don't mean to overstep. I know the hotel amenities aren't mine to tweak, but you have to admit, caramel s'more? That sounds pretty damn good.
Mario, she says, are you dating other people?
Mario's eyes jump up from the dessert plate to meet hers. Why are you asking me that?
She holds his gaze. Their relationship is still so new that she's made a little dizzy by how attractive he is. Those bedroom eyes, the sly smile. But she realizes she doesn't know him well enough to tell if he's been hiding something. She shakes her head. Never mind. I'm drunk, I think.
Okay, Mario says. I'll get the check.
He turns around, the check appears. Lisbeth tries to give him her credit card, but he hands it back without saying anything. Is he upset? Has she ruined the evening? There's no way Yolanda's myriad daily visits to the kitchen and her presence with the Blue Bar staff on their day off is a coincidence. Something is going on. Hey, the text said, indicating a previous conversation, a context. Can you help me with a thing later? The help is sexual. The thing is Yolanda's desire for him, and later is after service at the restaurant. The smutty emoji speaks for itself. Why doesn't Mario ever ask to come to Lisbeth's cottage after work? Because he's dating Yolanda as well. He has Lisbeth for lunch and Yolanda for a midnight snack. Why are you asking me that? That answer isn't a firm no. It isn't any kind of no. Lisbeth wants to press him,
But she's not sure she'll believe him if he says he's not seeing anyone else, and she won't be able to bear it if he says yes, he is dating other people, because they never explicitly stated that they were exclusive. Mario warned Lisbeth to be careful, but she dove headlong into a new relationship, as if her previous relationship hadn't hurt her badly enough. She's such an idiot. She hasn't learned a thing, and she hasn't changed. Lisbeth makes it out of the restaurant and down to Mario's pickup. Once they're both sitting in the dark truck, he looks at her. What's going on, Heartbreaker? Don't call me that, she says, though she loves the nickname.
Do you want to come back to my place so we can talk this through? Or would you like me to take you home?
Lisbeth stares into her lap. Talk this through. That seems to indicate there's something to talk through. Of course there is. All Lisbeth can see when she closes her eyes is Yolanda jumping into Mario's arms at home plate, Yolanda kissing him right on the lips, and the blasted text, "Hey, can you help me with a thing later?" That hideous emoji face, it's the emoji that bothers her the most. Home, please. They drive in silence to Bear Street, and Lisbeth can feel the cab of the truck filling with his confusion. But he says nothing, and she's grateful. When they pull into her driveway, she knows she can still salvage things. Invite him in, hope he stays the night. But instead she says, I haven't been careful. I let myself feel too much too soon. And because of what happened with JJ, I need to take a step back. It's for my own mental well-being. Mario covers her hand with his.
I'm feeling a lot of things too, Lisbeth.
Lisbeth shakes her head. You're not feeling the same things I'm feeling. Mario laughs.
You don't know that. Why did you ask if I was seeing other people?
Lisbeth shrugs. She can't say Yolanda's name. It's just a sense I get.
Your sense is wrong.
Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, Lisbeth thinks. I can't get hurt again, Mario.
Lisbeth, come on. How about a little faith?
She glares out the windshield at her tiny shingled cottage, a cottage she bought with someone else. She had faith once upon a time. It didn't work out. Mario sighs.
Is it okay if I walk you to the door?
She doesn't answer, but he does it anyway, giving Lisbeth one last chance to change course. Why can't she just treat this relationship like an easygoing summer romance with great sex, water views, and delicious meals? It started out that way. But then there were the roses he brought her in the Tom and Jerry jelly jar, and the lunch when he cried, telling Lisbeth about his cousin Hector, who died of liver cancer. At another lunch, Lisbeth was so tired that she skipped sex and skipped eating and just fell asleep on Mario's bed. And she woke up an hour later to him kissing her eyelids, and he handed her a brown paper bag with a homemade pan bagnat for her to take back to the hotel. She thinks about how he called Christina Tina, and how he never starts the car unless she has her seatbelt fastened, and how he holds her face when he kisses her, his fingertips always grazing her earlobes. All of these things accumulated, and now, suddenly, Lisbeth finds herself losing her grip on her good sense. Something secret is going on with Yolanda. Maybe it's unspoken or unpursued, but there's a fondness, a flirtation, and Lisbeth is both jealous and disappointed in herself for being jealous. She has to get out. Now. Mario gives her a kiss that is tender enough to make her change her mind, and she nearly relents. How can she give this up? But in the end, she pulls away. Good night, Mario.
Good night, Heartbreaker, he says.
July 25th, 2022. From Xavier Darling, xd at darlingent.com.uk. To employees of the Hotel Nantucket. Good morning. I just want to let you know how encouraging it is that the world has discovered the hotel and that reservations are where they should be, at 100% occupancy. The reviews on the Travel Tattler website are a testament to everyone's hard work and dedication. But this week, one staff member was mentioned above all others, and once again that was Alessandra Powell. Keep up the good work, everyone.
XD. Every time Grace sees Alessandra enter a gentleman's guest room at night, she steers clear. Alessandra is sleeping with the guests, Mr. Brownlee, Mr. Yamaguchi, Dr. Romano, in exchange for them writing travel tattler reviews that specifically mention her, a ploy that has so far earned her $4,000 in bonus money. However, when Grace sees Alessandra go up the side stairs with a man named Bone Williams, she gets a dreadful feeling. She's annoyed by this. The last person she wants to rescue is the little witchy witch Alessandra, but her foreboding is too strong to ignore. When Bone Williams checked in, Grace saw flashing red lights and heard an obnoxious alarm sounding, but she chalked this up to toxic masculinity. Bone, what a name, she thought, another man referencing his penis. He arrived on the first car ferry of the day, stormed into the lobby at 9:30, and asked Edie why the hell there was no valet parking and what was he supposed to do with his Corvette Stingray because he couldn't just leave it on the street. Edie was the model of calm patience. She told Mr. Williams that the hotel had only 12 parking spots and those were reserved for people staying in the suites. Bone then told Edie with a barely concealed snarl that he had tried to get a suite, but they were all booked. You can't penalize me for that. Bone Williams was on the short side, but very muscular. He probably lifted. Grace would put him at 35 or so, which felt young for his level of entitlement.
My room had better be ready.
It's 9:30, Edie said. Our guaranteed check-in time is 3 p.m., but we'll do our best to get you in long before that, Mr. Williams.
3 o'clock? Bone shouted. You have got to be, he swallowed a word, kidding me.
We have a complimentary continental breakfast, which you can enjoy on the porch, or I can have it delivered to you at the adult pool, Edie said. Or if you'd like to stroll into town for breakfast, we highly recommend the Lemon Press on Main Street.
I'm not strolling anywhere, Bone said. I want to check into my room, not wander the property like a hobo when I've paid good money to stay here. And I need a secure spot for my stingray.
I'll contact you as soon as your room has been cleaned, Edie said. Unfortunately, the guests in that room haven't checked out yet.
Don't give me that crap, Bone said. Let me speak to your manager.
At this point, Edie smiled. Certainly. She turned to Alessandra. Mr. Williams, this is Alessandra Powell, our front desk manager.
Alessandra said, You drive a Corvette Stingray? Wasn't that the pace car for last year's Indy 500?
Bone's demeanor instantly changed.
It was, yes.
He slid over to Alessandra's position at the desk and drank in her appearance. Her hair was braided with a hydrangea blue scarf woven through, and she was wearing the white eyeliner and eye crystals that seemed to mesmerize every man she spoke to, including Bone Williams.
Hey, your name tag is upside down.
He did the unfunny shtick of craning his neck, trying to read it.
Alessandra.
Grace gave a ghostly eye roll. Every single man Alessandra has checked in this summer has said exactly the same thing. Alessandra jotted something down on a yellow sticky note and Grace read it over her shoulder. Yes, followed by a phone number. I'm fairly certain that the couple staying in Suite 217 have come with bicycles only, Alessandra says, so let me see if you might be able to use their parking spot.
Oh man, Bone said, that would be amazing.
He plunked down his Centurion card and his driver's license, which gave a Park Avenue address in New York City.
Humph,
Grace thought. I'm afraid Edie was correct about your check-in, Alessandra said. But a Bloody Mary by our pool is a very pleasant way to start your Nantucket vacation, and I can pop out in a little while to check on you. Alessandra ran the Centurion card and matched the picture on his license to his face with a wink. Bone softened like a butter statue in the sun. Grace had learned about butter statues from listening to Lisbeth. It was a Minnesota thing.
I don't care about the room. Just please tell me you'll have dinner with me tomorrow night at Topper's. I'll take you up there in the Ray, but I can't promise I'll stick to the speed limit.
Alessandra pressed the sticky note to Bone's license before handing it back. I'm afraid dating the guests is against our rules. I wish I could. I love toppers, and who wouldn't want to ride in that car?
Bone read the sticky note and grinned. My loss, then, he said. Figured it couldn't hurt to ask.
Alessandra secured Suite 217's parking spot for Bone Williams's Corvette, and Grace assumes they did go for dinner at Topper's. Now, Grace watches Bone and Alessandra going up the side stairs. Most likely, Alessandra wants to avoid Richie and Adam, who are working in the lobby. When they reach room 310, Bone shoves her inside. Grudgingly, Grace follows them. Bone Williams is drunk. Topper's is a good 10 miles away along the curving Pulpus Road, and Grace shudders to think about him driving home in that sports car in this state. Alessandra, frankly, is lucky to be alive. Bone pushes Alessandra onto the bed and reaches under her dress, a vintage Diane von Furstenberg wrap in a gorgeous print. Alessandra has impeccable taste. Grace has to give her that. Alessandra deftly knocks his hand away and says, Hey now, play nice.
You ordered a $500 Barolo at dinner, he says. You owe me.
You asked me to pick the wine, Alessandra says. You told me you wanted something extraordinary. And, as I'm sure a man like you knows, extraordinary comes at a price. If I was on a budget, you should have told me.
Budget?
Bone says like it's a dirty word. He pulls Alessandra across the bed toward him as she tries to scoot to the other side.
You little whore.
He rips open the front of her dress, and Grace winces but doesn't intervene. Some people like rough sex. She has been haunting the hotel long enough to know this. When Bone unzips his pants, Alessandra says, No. I'm saying no. I'm leaving, Bone.
You're not going anywhere,
Bone says. He grabs Alessandra's wrists and pins them over her head. Despite Alessandra's thrashing, she isn't screaming, so she must be worried about getting caught. Bone holds her tight. He reaches up her skirt. This is such a drastic situation that Grace knows lights and music and the shades won't stop him. She coils all of her energy until it's as dangerous as a packed snowball with an icy core and hits Bone Williams in the jaw. Bone staggers back, giving Alessandra a chance to scramble off the bed. When he grabs her shin, she kicks him in the face, bloodying his nose. She runs out the door and down the hall to the third floor storage closet, where she catches her breath and assesses the damage. She has bracelets of red fingerprints around her wrists. Her dress is in shreds. She has lost a shoe. Alessandra strips down and puts on one of the hotel robes and a pair of slippers. Tears are streaming down her face, and when she wipes them away, she stares at her fingers as though she can't figure out why they're wet. She peeks out the closet door. She wisely decides not to go past room 310, instead sneaking down the stairs at the opposite end of the building and, from there, out into the night. You owe me one, Missy, Grace thinks. She feels depleted. She's getting too old for this. But even so, Grace can't help heading right back to room 310 to mess with Bone Williams's lights, play Tiffany's I Think We're Alone Now at top volume, raise and lower his shades, and blow Arctic air into the space where his heart is supposed to be. Chapter 18. Last Friday of the month. July. The first shot of Shelley Carpenter's July Instagram post is of a mannequin bust sitting on an antique trunk in slanting rays of sunlight, and Lisbeth wonders if maybe she has the wrong account. But then she double-checks the header and reads the caption. Ah, she thinks. She clicks on the link in the bio just as Adam, who has come to the hotel specifically so he can dish with them, and Edie step into her office. Together, they read. Hotel Confidential by Shelley Carpenter. July 29th, 2022. Sea Castle Bed and Breakfast, Hyannisport, Massachusetts. Three keys. Hello again, friends. There are bed and breakfast people, and then there is yours truly. However, in the spirit of reviewing every kind of lodging, I bring to you my thoughts on the Sea Castle B&B in the bustling hamlet of Hyannisport, Massachusetts, on storied old Cape Cod. Sea Castle is a Victorian mansion that was restored by its owners to meticulous period detail in 2015. It has 8 guest rooms and a first-floor living and dining common area that offers a breakfast of champions each morning between 8 and 9. My room, on the second floor, had a king-size canopy bed that was so high off the ground, an actual wooden step was provided. There were, in my humble opinion, too many layers of bed linens for summertime, a top sheet, a velveteen blanket, a duvet, and a heavy brocade coverlet. The other furnishings were straight out of grandmother's house in a fairy tale, an Eastlake dresser covered with a faintly stained doily, a rocking chair, and a trunk at the foot of the bed. When I opened the trunk, I found a bald, featureless bust that startled me so badly, I dropped the lid of the trunk and smashed a finger. What was a head and torso doing in the trunk of my room? When I asked the proprietress, she told me the original owner of the house had been a milliner, and that was her hatmaker's dummy. This, friends, is my number one issue with a B&B. You're living in someone else's home. I felt churlish asking that the head and shoulders be removed, however, ask I did. The bathroom was tiny with no surface for toiletries, so I placed mine on the back of the toilet, a decision that landed my moisturizer in the bowl. The bathroom had a fuzzy pink rug, and friends, you know how I feel about rugs or carpeting of any kind in bathrooms. The sink's drain was sluggish, and the shower, while giving decent pressure, was subject to sudden drastic changes in temperature, probably due to the Hubertsons on the same floor flushing their toilet. Although I bristled at the strict timetable for breakfast, I was in my seat promptly at 8. The proprietress brought out freshly squeezed orange juice and a fruit salad that included blueberries, raspberries, blackberries, sliced peaches, and fresh figs. She won me over with the figs. The main course was a mushroom herb and gooey brie frittata with a side of crisp bacon and a golden hash brown patty. Also on offer were banana pecan muffins and cheddar scones. The breakfast was the most delicious I've eaten in my life. Yes, friends, better than the croissant with butter and apricot jam at the Shangri-La in Paris. Better than the congee at the Raffles in Singapore. But my infatuation with the food was mitigated by the need to chat with the proprietress and the Hubertsons about which shop in town had the best Panoush fudge and how much of a ripoff the whale-watching trips were. By the end of the meal, I was longing for the freedom and anonymity of a proper hotel. In the end, I balanced the mediocrity of the Sea Castle accommodations, the sluggish drain, the unsettling contents of the trunk, against the extraordinary breakfast, and I arrived at 3 keys. Those of you who love quilts, stained glass, oak sideboards, cross-stitch, green apple-scented candles, country charm, and good-hearted chit-chat may have arrived at 4 keys, but on this point, we'll have to differ. Stay well, friends, and do good. S.C.
I can't believe she went to a bed and breakfast, Adam says. Has she ever done that before? Next thing you know, she'll be reviewing Airbnbs.
I thought she was harsh, Edie says. My mom wanted to buy the Winter Street Inn a few years ago when Mitzi Quinn put it up for sale, but my dad talked her out of it. It's a lot of work, running those places. I like bed and breakfasts. I think they're quaint and cozy.
Adam groans. Death by cross-stitch.
Lisbeth happens to agree with Adam, but she won't weigh in. She has something bigger on her mind.
Hyannisport, she says. Shelley Carpenter is getting closer.
Chapter 19. The Blanket, the Belt, the Burglary.
August 1st, 2022. From Xavier Darling, xd at darlingent.com.uk. To employees of the Hotel Nantucket. Happy August, team. I'm pleased to offer this week's $1,000 bonus to a different staff member, Raul Wasserman Ramirez.
Raoul's excellent service at the bell stand was extolled by a large family who recently stayed with us. He went above and beyond the call of duty to meet their needs and always had a smile. That's what I like to hear. I'll be seeing you all in just a few weeks. XD.
August is the least favorite month of most people who work in the summer service industry, and Lisbeth is no exception. July is merely a dress rehearsal for the flat-out theater of the absurd production that is August. That was true at the deck. Every table, every night was booked with a VIP. Lisbeth once had to say no to Blake Shelton and Gwen Stefani requesting a table for 8 because she simply couldn't bump one of her regulars, but it killed her to do it. At the hotel, August is just as full as July. You can't get any fuller than full, but the clientele is more demanding. A woman named Diane Brickley insists that Edie rent her the room you keep vacant for VIP walk-ins. Edie comes to Lisbeth and says, I need your help. Alessandra is on lunch. Still? Lisbeth says. Alessandra has been pushing the envelope where lunch is concerned. The day before, she was gone for 90 minutes. And when Lisbeth spoke to her about it, Alessandra shrugged and said, fire me. Which, of course, Lisbeth couldn't do. Not in August. Lisbeth pokes her head out her office door. Diane Brickley is, Lisbeth would guess, nearly 80 years old. She looks like one of the ladies who eat lunch every day on the patio of the Field and Oar Club. She's wearing a knee-length Nantucket red skirt that she probably bought at Murray's Toggery back in the 1960s. It's faded to pale pink, a yellow slicker, and a rain bonnet. The forecast did call for thunderstorms, but out the front doors of the hotel, Lisbeth sees golden sunshine. There's an antique Nantucket lightship basket hanging from Diane Brickley's forearm. Lisbeth realizes that Diane Brickley is one of the Field and Oar ladies, and she sits on the board of directors at the Nantucket Lightship Basket Museum. She lives at 388 Main Street. Hello, Mrs. Brickley. It's Lisbeth Keaton. Diane waves a hand. At least somebody here knows me. I have my daughter visiting with her 4 teenage sons, and I can't handle the noise, the smell, or the mess. Please put me in the room you save for visiting dignitaries. Hotels do not keep rooms vacant for VIP walk-ins. That's a myth. I'm sorry, Mrs. Brickley, Lisbeth says. We're full. We don't have a single room available. Full? Mrs. Brickley says. The White Elephant is full, the Beach Club is full, and the Walwinet is full. But I thought for sure you'd have a room available. Isn't this place haunted? Guests have been posting their accounts of visits from the ghost of Grace Hadley all over social media. Nothing that Grace does shows up on anyone's camera, but these people get likes and follows and reposts anyway. Derek White, a fourth-grade teacher from Shaker Heights, reported seeing a ghost reflected in his dark bedroom window. He claimed she was wearing one of the hotel bathrobes and a Minnesota Twins cap. A few days later, guest Elaine Backler was applying eyebrow pencil when she saw a floating robe and navy baseball hat in the mirror behind her. Lisbeth is certain Elaine must have heard about Derek's sighting and was corroborating it to stoke intrigue. The detail about the Twins cap, though, nags at Lisbeth. She misplaced her own navy Minnesota Twins baseball hat sometime during her first week of work, and it hasn't turned up. The Washington Post calls, then USA Today, but all Lisbeth can tell them for sure is that a chambermaid was killed in a fire at the hotel 100 years earlier. Is Grace Hadley now haunting the hotel? It's anyone's guess, Lisbeth says lightly. The phone rings nonstop. People have started booking rooms for the following summer. Lisbeth wants to tell Mario about this. Tell him he was wrong that the hotel might be a flash in the pan. Lisbeth is half full for next June already, but she has consciously avoided any situation in which she might see Mario. She hasn't texted or called. He called her once at midnight, waking her up. It took extreme willpower, but she let the call go to voicemail, and he didn't leave a message. He also sent Beatrice to the front desk with a bakery box, the homemade pizza rolls, the gougère, the donuts, and Lisbeth brought it directly to the break room for everyone else to enjoy. She longs for him every second of every day. Her new obsession is monitoring Yolanda's trips to and from the Blue Bar kitchen. Yolanda seems to go mostly in the morning and the afternoon, and Lisbeth knows that Mario doesn't arrive until 4, or when he wanted to make out with Lisbeth in her office, 3:30. Yolanda also visits the kitchen in the late afternoon right before service starts, so this is when Lisbeth watches her most closely. Does she seem ravished? Not really. She's as serene as always, and she's never weird or tense around Lisbeth. One day, she stops at the desk and gives Lisbeth an appraising look, and Lisbeth thinks, here it comes. She's going to say, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize. I hope you can forgive. I never meant to hurt. Yolanda says, you look like a person in need of a yoga class. How about 30 minutes in Savasana pose? Lisbeth manages a smile. Although Yolanda is right, Lisbeth can't imagine ever practicing with her again. Not after all this. I'm fine, thanks, she says. It's just August. Lisbeth worries beads along a mental string. Mario, Mario, Yolanda, Mario, Yolanda. But then something steals her full attention. It's 11 o'clock on Thursday, August 4th, and the lobby is popping. Louis is playing Mr. Tennant from room 201 in chess, and the match is so close, there's a little crowd around them. It includes Richie and an exasperated Kimber Marsh, who are waiting for Louis to finish so they can all go to the 167 raw food truck for tuna burgers and then to Cisco Beach. Edie is on the phone with the galley trying to secure a beachfront lunch reservation for room 110, and Alessandra is calling the Highline to make a reservation for the Keenan family, who somehow neglected to arrange for their transport home. Lisbeth is about to head to the percolator. It will be her 8th cup of coffee, which is a lot, even for her, when she notices a woman enter the lobby. This woman is dressed in the best kind of casual way, cute jeans, a white blouse that's as crisp as paper, and gladiator sandals. She's rolling in a hunter green away carry-on, which is the exact same bag that Lisbeth travels with. Her dark hair is cut in a bob at her jawline, and she's wearing chic glasses. None of this is particularly remarkable, but Lisbeth gets a feeling. The woman stops just inside the entrance to the lobby to look around. She whips out her phone and begins to take pictures and type notes. Lisbeth hurries over. Welcome to the Hotel Nantucket, she says. Adam always sings this. It's a fun touch, but Lisbeth can't pull it off. May I help with your bag? Thank you, the woman says. She follows Lisbeth to the desk, where she pulls out her Washington, D.C. driver's license and a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express, both in the name of Claire Underwood. Claire Underwood. Washington, D.C. House of Cards, Lisbeth thinks. Lisbeth and JJ watched all 6 seasons. Here's what Lisbeth has been waiting for, an inside joke alias. Lisbeth tries to act natural. She wishes that she could let Edie and Alessandra and Raoul and Adam and Zeke know that Shelley Carpenter is in the house. They should have come up with a secret signal word like Amsterdam or unicycle. Why did Lisbeth not think to do that? They all knew this day would come. Shelley posted her review of the bed and breakfast in Hyannisport only 5 days earlier. Maybe she popped over to the Vineyard to check out the Winnetou or the Charlotte Inn, and now she's here on Nantucket. She's purposely arrived at 11 in the morning, which is the most frenetic time of the day because of guests checking out. Lisbeth quickly reviews the reservation. 3 nights in a standard deluxe room, paid in full, booked on July 5th, the day of Lisbeth's first date with Mario, she can't help thinking. Claire Underwood booked long before all the brouhaha about the ghost. Lisbeth says, "It's so wonderful to have you staying with us, Ms. Underwood. Are you visiting Nantucket for any special reason?" Claire slash maybe Shelley smiles. "Just a quick getaway," she says. "I was curious about the hotel." Lisbeth bites her lower lip to keep from giving Claire slash maybe Shelley an unhinged grin. "There are a few things you should know about our property. Technically, check-in is at 3. I understand," Claire slash maybe Shelley says.
but I'll try to get you into your room as soon as possible. Lisbeth goes on to tell Claire/maybe Shelley about the adult pool and the wellness center, and then she hands Claire/maybe Shelley a copy of the Blue Book. This lists all of our recommendations for shopping, restaurants, beaches, galleries, bars, and nightlife. If you have any requests, please let me know. Lisbeth realizes with horror that she has forgotten to introduce herself. I'm Lisbeth Keaton, the general manager. I do have some requests, actually, Claire/maybe Shelley says, pulling a piece of paper out of her cute woven clutch. First off, would it be possible for me to get a room upgrade? A room upgrade? Lisbeth thinks. The hotel is full. But she understands that Claire/maybe Shelley has to ask. It's what savvy travelers and famous hotel bloggers do. How will they ever get the fifth key if Lisbeth can't accommodate this request? They won't, is the answer. Then Lisbeth realizes that they do have one free room, Xavier's suite, which is awaiting his arrival on August 24th. Richie has asked Lisbeth why she doesn't rent the room out since they know Xavier's dates, and Lisbeth said she wouldn't feel right. Xavier asked her to hold it for him. He's been paying the nightly rate all summer. Lisbeth is certain that the day she agrees to let someone take Xavier's suite, Xavier will appear out of the blue for a surprise visit. But Shelley Carpenter is a special case. I bought the hotel to impress two women. If Lisbeth doesn't offer Shelley the owner's suite, she reasons, Xavier will be furious. I can upgrade you to the owner's suite, Lisbeth says, and she watches Claire/maybe Shelley's eyebrows lift. Excellent, thank you, Claire/maybe Shelley says. I also have these requests. She slides the piece of paper across the desk. Thursday, 7:30 p.m., Pearl Bar Seat. Friday, 7 o'clock p.m., Nautilus Bar Seat. Saturday, 8 o'clock p.m., Blue Bar Bar Seat. Four-door Jeep Wrangler Hardtop Saturday. Please also arrange pickup of charcuterie platter from Petrichor. Stand-up paddle lesson, Friday noon. Tour of Cisco Brewers, Friday, 5 o'clock p.m. Yoga class before 10 o'clock a.m., Friday through Sunday. I'll handle all this right away, Lisbeth says. She's relieved the deck isn't on Claire/maybe Shelley's list. Do you have any other luggage? I'll have Zeke, our bellman, bring it up to you right away. No, Claire/maybe Shelley says, just this. Well then, give me a few minutes to have housekeeping prepare your room and I'll walk you up myself. We have complimentary Jamaica Blue Mountain coffee in the percolator. Fantastic, Claire/maybe Shelley says. I missed my coffee this morning, and I love percolated coffee. It's such a nice touch. A cheer goes up from the chess match. Louis has beaten Mr. Tennant. Lisbeth takes this as a good omen. The hotel will win Claire/maybe Shelley over. They will get the fifth key. What's not a good omen is the icy silence on the other end of the telephone line when Lisbeth calls Magda to tell her to prepare the owner's suite, 317, for a guest check-in. That's Xavier's suite, Magda says. Mr. Darling's, yes, Lisbeth says, but since he's not here, I would strongly advise against putting anyone in Xavier's suite, Magda says. He's paying to keep it empty. Shelley Carpenter is here, Lisbeth whispers. She asked for an upgrade. Magda clears her throat. You're sure it's her? Beyond a shadow of a doubt? No one is ever sure, but there's been more than one indication. Fine. Give us 15 minutes to stock the minibar, dust, and plump the pillows for Ms. Carpenter. You need to do more than that, Lisbeth says. You need to run through the checklist. What if there are cobwebs? What if the windows stick? What if the sound system is doing that funny stuttering thing? And make sure the pens work and that the sink drains properly. Perhaps you'd like to come up and do my job for me? Magda asks, and Lisbeth presses her lips together. Lisbeth suspects that, although she is Magda's boss, Magda sees it as the other way around. Not at all, Magda, Lisbeth says. Thank you. She has quietly informed the staff that the woman posing as Claire Underwood, who is staying in Suite 317, might very well be Shelley Carpenter.
Lisbeth has also told the staff not to overdo it. The last thing they want is for Claire slash maybe Shelley to think her cover is blown and figure out she's receiving special service. If that happens, she won't write the review at all. From the looks of things, Claire slash maybe Shelley is having a wonderful time. She drinks the percolated coffee in the morning, takes an interest in Louis's chess matches, raves about her yoga class with Yolanda, rides one of the free bikes into town to shop and get lunch at the beat. She lounges by the adult pool, takes her tours and lessons, and heads out for her solo dinners stylishly dressed. Lisbeth's favorite look is white jeans, a sleeveless black bodysuit, and leopard print wedges. Late on Saturday afternoon, Claire slash maybe Shelley stops by the front desk and says, "Where did you source those blue cashmere blankets? I'd like to get one to take home." "Nantucket looms," Lisbeth says. She checks the time. "They're closed now, but they open tomorrow at 10. "Darn," Claire slash maybe Shelley says. "My flight leaves at 10. "Let me see what I can do," Lisbeth says. She goes to the second floor housekeeping storage where they keep half a dozen extra blue blankets. Lisbeth wraps one up in hydrangea blue tissue. Is she being too obvious? Too heavy-handed? Will Claire slash maybe Shelley see the blanket for what it is? A bribe? Lisbeth takes the risk and presents Claire slash maybe Shelley with the blanket the next morning when she checks out. Claire slash maybe Shelley seems genuinely overcome by the gesture. So thoughtful, thank you, her stay at the hotel has been an utter delight. "I'm a pretty tough customer," Claire slash maybe Shelley says, "but I've never been as won over by a hotel stay as I have by this one."
"Yes," Lisbeth thinks. "Yes, yes, 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 yes."
After Claire slash maybe Shelley walks out the front door, trailing her away carry-on behind her, Lisbeth wants to high-five her staff, but she exercises restraint. They can all celebrate on the last Friday of the month when the Hotel Nantucket becomes the only property to ever receive 5 keys. For now, Lisbeth will remain cautiously optimistic. The next morning, Edie knocks on Lisbeth's office door. Claire Underwood is on the phone and has asked for Lisbeth personally. Something's up. In the housekeeping office, Magda assigns Octavia and Paz the first floor checkouts, but instead of sending Chad and Bibi to the second floor, she closes the office door.
"The two of you were responsible for the checkout of Suite 317 yesterday, were you not?" Magda asks.
"We were," Chad says.
He was, frankly, amazed that Magda assigned him and Bibi, rather than Octavia and Paz, to the owner's suite, but he took it as a vote of confidence. They've been doing good work. But yesterday, only Chad did good work. Bibi was in a foul mood, and when Chad asked her what was wrong, she said that her baby daddy, some dude named Johnny Quarter, had left the state without a trace, and with him went the $500 a month child support payments. She had her aunt report Johnny Quarter to Domestic Relations, who issued a summons.
"But doing that doesn't get me my money," Bibi said.
She spent most of the time in Suite 317 working like a person underwater. The owner's suite was bigger and grander than the other suites in the hotel. The Nantucket Night Sky mural was painted in finer detail. The library had brass rails and a sliding ladder to reach the upper shelves. There was a separate dressing room, and the second bedroom was an elegant study complete with a built-in desk. On the walls hung prints of the hotel in the early 20th century. There were cream and blue Persian carpets instead of rainbow-hued Annie Selke rugs throughout, and the bathroom included a steam sauna. It was very extra.
"Why did they rent out this room?" Bibi asked. "The owner isn't here."
"I guess they thought Shelley Carpenter showed up," Chad said.
"I have no idea who that is," Bibi said.
"She has this Instagram account and blog called Hotel Confidential," he said. "Don't you follow her?"
"Why would I follow something called Hotel Confidential?" Bibi asked,
and Chad thought, "Because you work in a hotel?"
But he had to admit he'd never heard of the Hotel Confidential blog until Lisbeth mentioned it during their first staff meeting.
Chad checked it out and fell down the rabbit hole, scrolling through a bunch of Shelley's past posts and clicking on her bio to read the reviews. Shelley Carpenter had been everywhere, to the Angama Mara Safari Camp in Kenya, and the Maliuhana in Anguilla, and Las Ventanas al Paraiso in Cabo. But she also reviewed more modest places, like motels on Route 66 and beach bungalows in Koh Samui, Thailand. The way she described these places was so detailed and precise that Chad felt like he'd been there too. It was exciting to think that she'd been to their hotel. Maybe, no one could be sure. He wondered what she was going to write about the place.
Well, it's a thing, she's internet famous, and Lisbeth offered her this suite as an upgrade.
Internet famous? Bibi said. She paused. Why don't you do the bathroom, long shot? I'll finish the bed. Ms. English says, the guest called to say she left behind a black suede Gucci belt. I went through the suite myself but didn't find it. Ms. English gives them both a death stare. Did either of you see it?
I didn't see a Gucci belt, Bibi says, or any belt.
Have you checked the laundry?
Yes, Barbara,
Ms. English says, and both Chad and Bibi stiffen. Has Ms. English ever used Bibi's real name before? No. They're in trouble, Chad thinks. Bibi is in trouble. Bibi took the Gucci belt, of course, just like she lifted Mrs. Daly's Fendi scarf. At some point when Chad was cleaning the bathroom of the owner's suite, he noticed the door had been closed behind him. He heard the vacuum running, and he'd nearly poked his head out to check on Bibi. The reason he hadn't checked on Bibi, he admits to himself now, was that he hadn't wanted to know if she was actually vacuuming or just using the noise as a cover. She was upset about money, the loss of $500 a month, the specter of having to pay a private investigator to track down the baby daddy. The guest in the room, Claire/maybe Shelley, had left a $60 tip, and as always, Chad told Bibi to just take the whole thing, which she did with her usual attitude of entitlement, even though half of it was rightfully his. But apparently, that hadn't been enough. She had taken Claire/maybe Shelley's Gucci belt.
What did the belt look like? Chad asks.
Black suede with a rose gold double G buckle, Ms. English says.
Bibi probably already has it up on eBay or Craigslist, Chad thinks. She'll get $600 because those belts cost close to $800.
Chad knows this because his mother has a Gucci belt, and it's an egregious habit of hers to fake complain about exactly how much her wardrobe costs.
This is the second incident I've had with you two where something has gone missing.
Bibi glowers at Ms. English, her eyes like two cold, clear marbles.
I bet you haven't asked Octavia and Nevis about it, have you?
They didn't clean the room, Ms. English says.
But they have a master key, Bibi says. I'm telling you, they're trying to frame me.
This is the same outrageous claim Bibi made last time. It feels like a little kid pointing a finger at the playground. But her face shines with such indignant anger that Chad entertains that possibility for a second.